You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 25th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Nick Troiano of The Can Kicks Back, an organization aimed at the millennial generation to explain to them the crisis that we face with the debt. Where when Nick gets here, he'll give us a little bit more of an explicit explanation of that. These are the folks who are responsible for putting out these videos where they take an internet meme and combine it with a guy like Alan Simpson or Alice Rivkin or David Walker, people who are telling us that our debt crisis is the crisis we got to deal with now. And then they mix it with an internet meme to aim to these millennials, the kids. So Nick will talk to us about that project. Also on the program today, the sequester. We're only a couple of days away. Some highlights about what will be cut as we head into this wave of austerity. Also, Boeing with a new plan to salvage the Dreamliner. You know, there's this problem with the batteries on board, I guess, for their backup electrical systems. They catch fire. Well, they've got a great plan to deal with that. Also, health insurance rates have gone down, or at least let me rephrase that. The rate of increase of health insurance premiums has slowed considerably, perhaps because of the recession, perhaps in some respects because of Obamacare. And across the country, a new opportunity for students to say, hey, I don't buy this whole evolution thing, and not get penalized by those oppressive professors and teachers who want them to learn so-called science. And Ted Cruz has a message for you if you go to Harvard Law School. Watch out for all the commies. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we will get into all of that and more, your phone calls later in the program. But first, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nick Troiano. He is a representative, one of the co-founders of The Can Kicks Back. We'll be right back after this.
Through the window.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Nick Troiano. He is the field director for the Can Kicks Back. Welcome to the program, Nick.
Thanks, Sam, for having me.
So start off, tell us a little bit about your organization.
Sure. The Can Kicks Back was launched in November 2012 by a group of young people who've been following the issue of our growing national debt for a few years. And what we've been seeing is Washington continually kick the can down the road and delay tough budget choices. And we realize that can is really our generation and our future. And this campaign is meant for our generation to kick back at Washington by getting more involved and by pressuring our leaders to work together and enact a comprehensive deficit reduction agreement.
Okay, so, and you guys have put out a couple of videos. Let's play the latest one. And this is the one we should say that Matt tweeted out. He had a problem with your video. It's based on the Harlem Shake. Just tell us what we're gonna see. And I have to say that I'm obviously a little bit older. I didn't even know anything about the Harlem Shake. I had no idea that it what it was. But I've since Googled and seen what's going on. Just to set the table for us.
Sure. I mean, the whole tactic of our campaign is to try to communicate a serious message, but using humor to reach young people. And one way that we do that is sometimes by sort of hopping on viral memes and producing videos. And so this video features former budget director Alice Rivlin and former U.S. comptroller David Walker dancing in this, minute-and-a-half sketch where we talk about, you know, why young people should care about our national debt.
Okay, great. And so the message is specifically?
We can't keep dancing around this issue.
Right, we can't keep dancing around. Okay, let's play the clip.
The Congressional Budget Office's new report shows that our national debt will hit 77% of the gross domestic product by 2023. We can't grow our economy and have a prosperous America with debt growing that fast.
And you know, that will impact young people the most. Fewer jobs, higher taxes, a lower standard of living, more debt. What's going on in Washington is truly outrageous. It's time to shake things up.
You've got to get in.
Okay, I think we get the idea. We're obviously it's an audio show. People can't quite see, but people are dancing around crazy at that point. So now I got to say, starting off, Nick, now my audience, I know what my audience is thinking right now. They think that you think the argument here is that the number one crisis we face as a country is the debt and the deficit that is adding to that debt, and not a jobs crisis. Is that the case?
Well, I think it's often presented as a false choice. We do have a lot to worry about in the short term in terms of growing the economy, but we can't do that at the expense of ignoring what is the most critical issue facing our generation, which is our unsustainable fiscal path. If we do that, we'll only be setting ourselves up for a more predictable and perhaps more severe economic crisis years down the road if our debt continues to grow as it is. So our message is that we need a bold, generationally balanced, and bipartisan deficit reduction agreement that can both protect economic recovery in the short term and help bring our debt down to a sustainable level over the medium and long term.
Now, how does that happen? I mean, how do you cut our government and create growth at a time where we have such a tremendous, essentially, output gap in this country?
Well, one way to do it in terms of growing the economy and reducing the deficit is, you know, an issue that's before the Congress now is what to do about sort of comprehensive tax reform. We have an antiquated and dilapidated tax code that's over 73,000 pages. There's ways to make it a lot simpler and fairer through closing a lot of loopholes that can help with growing the economy and at the same time generate a bit more revenue to deal with the deficit. And if you couple that with comprehensive entitlement reform, that begins to look like, you know, the next sort of grand bargain package that both sides can agree to.
Now, well, now let me ask you that, but just on those two things. You're talking about tax reform and cutting entitlements. By that, you mean Social Security and Medicare. How does cutting Social Security and Medicare, how does that grow the economy?
Well, I think what we'll see is that the economy can't be sustained over the long term with the trajectory of these entitlement programs because of the way that our population is aging and because of the growth rate in healthcare costs.
Well, so, now I agree with you on the cost of healthcare costs, but wait a second. But I'm curious as to right now, you say we can do both these things right now. How does cutting entitlements in the future, and we can talk about whether or not we should do that, but how does that grow jobs now?
What I'm saying is that by making gradual changes in those social insurance programs now, it won't do anything severe to jeopardize our economic recovery, which can be aided and shepherded along through other things that we can do in the short term, including making some needed public investments in, you know, infrastructure and education and research. So the advantage of doing deficit reduction in sort of a grand bargain style is that we can make decisions now that will be phased in gradually and at the same time not do anything to jeopardize our economic recovery.
So those aren't necessarily related. I mean, you're not saying that cutting the entitlements will create jobs.
Not in the short term necessarily, but what I'm saying is if we don't do that, then we're only setting ourselves up for our next economic crisis years down the road.
Now, how?
And the sooner that we act, which this is a really important point, the sooner that we act, the less dramatic those changes have to be, and the
now
less
how will
people
how will
have to affect.
How will cutting Social Security or cutting Medicare? Now, I think we're in agreement that the number one driver of our long-term deficits is the cost of medicine. It's not necessarily Medicare, except for obviously. That's a program in which we help seniors pay for medicine, but it's the cost of medicine that is the problem, right? I mean, the rate of growth in Medicare, for instance, is much less in terms of cost than it is in the private insurance industry.
Right. So I think you're right about that, but I think the United States is the only developed country in the world that doesn't have a budget for what we spend on healthcare. Right now, it's just growing on autopilot, and that isn't a sustainable way to budget for government. But at the same time, we just don't want to shift costs to, regular Americans. So we have to do more in terms of reforms that can slow the growth rate of healthcare costs. And we can do that, for example, by, using the government's purchasing power to better negotiate prescription drug prices and reforming medical liability insurance. There are still many other things that we can do to build on some of the reforms that were in the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Yeah, we can. I would love to see us negotiate for those prescription drug prices. But why does that involve cutting? So you're not proposing cutting benefits to Medicare. You're just talking about changing the way that we pay and maybe heading towards a single payer system.
Well, I think everything has to be on the table to make sure that program is sustainably solvent. We should look at what to do about the age of Medicare eligibility. We should look at means testing the program so that wealthier Americans pay, a larger share of the costs. We have to look at reimbursement rates to Medicare providers. We have to do all of those things to make sure that that program is going to be there for the next generation when we retire and become eligible.
Now, we already do means testing on Medicare Part B, I think it is, and some other aspects of Medicare. But when you talk about raising the eligibility age, aren't you talking about pushing those medical care costs onto ordinary Americans? I mean, because they're still going to have to pay, right? I mean, you're still going to have to pay for your private insurance if you're not on Medicare. And in fact, there's every reason to believe that those costs would go up because you're older. I mean, I know that, I'm not your age. I was at one point. But as I get older, my health insurance costs go up.
Well, I think what we're saying is that the way the programs run now isn't sustainable. For every $3, a person gets in Medicare benefits, they only paid $1 into the system. So we need every reform and every idea to be on the table in developing ways for this program to be solvent, because the worst option that we have is the status quo. especially for young people.
Well, I agree with you.
If we look at what the Medicare board says, that, you know, the program is going to stop paying full benefits, you know, in the mid-2020s, what are we going to say then if we don't engage in sensible, gradual reforms now?
Well, I agree. I just don't see how, you know, putting people into the private health insurance industry is going to actually save them money. In fact, all the studies that I've seen on this will say that it will increase costs. Because ultimately, we already pay twice as much as any other nation for healthcare, and we don't even have a nationalized system. But let's move to Social Security. What's the why does cutting Social Security in any way benefit us?
Again, I think you're framing your question the wrong way. Social Security, the trustees have said the program's going to stop paying full benefits in 2036. So the question is, what can we do now to extend the life of a really important program? And again, there are good ideas that should be out there and on the table. One is sort of, you know, raising the cap on taxable wages. It's much lower. It captures a few much less percentage of national income than it did when Social Security was enacted
right. In
the 1930s. Again, we have to look at the retirement age, because when the program was established, the average person died before they started collecting their benefits. And we have to see, you know.
Well, that was that. I mean, you got to look at the age increase in longevity after the age of 65, right? I mean, you're talking a lot of that had to do with infant mortality rates when you're saying that people didn't collect it before they became 65. But if they're alive, they're paying into the system.
Well, certainly people are living a lot longer now than they used to, and certainly
not everybody. Over the age of 65, everybody in the bottom half of the income distribution is living about a year longer. You have a small cohort of people who are living older. I think even for working white men now, women, I think their age has actually gone down, their life expectancy.
Right, but the things that we're talking about aren't extreme. I mean, in the Simpson-Bowles proposal 2 years ago, you know, their proposal was to increase the retirement age to 68 by 2050 and to 69 by 2075. So we're not talking more than a couple of years over the next few decades. What tends to happen is that when you start talking about reforming these entitlement programs, you get a whole bunch of pushback, and the status quo results from that. And then, like I said, the status quo are really our worst option on the table. So I'd really love to hear, you know, what others' ideas are to reform these programs.
If we lift the cap, if we get rid of the cap, we go back to the amount of income that you say has been lost, which we agree on, we're about 75% of the way there, and you could actually just, raise taxes. I mean, we have our lowest amount of income taxes in this country, short of the past 10 years, than we've had essentially since World War II.
Mm-hmm. And I think generally speaking, you know, the can kicks back. We're not out there, pushing specific policies or recommendations. There are good ideas out there on both sides. We probably need a combination of both. What's really missing is the political will to do this. People are worried about their own elections, their own political parties, their own narrow interests, when really we should be thinking about what's in the best interest of the country and the future.
But isn't the real concern? I mean, you I noticed you sent a letter to the editor replying to Paul Krugman's piece at the beginning of this month, where he was suggesting kick that can. His argument was that we don't have a debt crisis right now. Our deficit has shrunk at the fastest rate it shrunk in 70 years over the past 3 years. The number one driver of our long-term debt issue is healthcare, not necessarily the government's insurance program, but healthcare in and of itself. And he said that the contractionary effects of fiscal austerity, which is what we're talking about when we're talking about raising taxes or cutting government spending, will be devastating to the economy. And that's been echoed by the IMF and just about every – in fact, I don't know if there's ever been an example of austerity creating growth ever. Certainly
well,
not at a time
sort
of
an extreme term to use to characterize what is being proposed by people who care about this issue. Austerity is what we're trying to avoid, because there will come a point in time where the debt as a percentage of the economy is so high and growth begins to slow. That's when you'll have to go for true
austerity measures.
Well,
how does that work?
Measures.
What is that percentage?
And I don't know. I'm not sure if there's an exact percentage. There's studies out there that show 80 to 90% of GDP, and we're on our way there.
Well, you know, wait a second. Now, the CBO report that that you cite in your letter says that, and it has pretty anemic growth. I mean, that we're talking about in that CBO report, under 2%, which would be well below the average over the past 70 years, even over the past 10 or 15 years, would take us to 77% of debt to GDP ratio. Japan has like a 200% GDP debt to GDP ratio, and they're not going through a crisis. They have anemic growth, but there's a lot of reasons behind that. But I mean, what 80 and 90%, we're not headed anywhere near that, are we?
I mean, you just said 77%. That seems awfully close to 80 to 90% to me. And it's not just what's going to happen, you know, within the window of 10 years. It's beyond that. You know, we've done some deficit reduction over the past couple of years that generally stabilizes the debt over the next few. But it does nothing to control sort of the long-term drivers. We've gutted discretionary spending to a large extent, but we haven't done and we haven't addressed the true drivers of the debt, which is going back to what we're talking about, aging population and rising health care costs.
Right. And so
and the other thing that ought to be of concern to people
who care
about growing the economy is what's happening with discretionary spending. Just look at what we're paying on interest. You know, last year alone it was $230 billion. That's more than we spent on, you know, departments of commerce, education, energy, homeland security, state, the federal courts, all combined. That's money, real money, that we can't be spending on investments in the future. And where we're headed, interest is going to triple over the next 10 years. That's certainly not going to help the economy in the short term, and that's not going to help to keep America competitive.
Well, will you explain to me how these projections, I mean, let's assume that the CBO projections are correct, which as we know, is a big assumption. In 2007, the CBO's projections were obviously wildly off. We know that this the enormous deficits that we're dealing with now are a function of the economy crashing, right? I mean, because in 2007, the deficit was just 1.2% of GDP, and it's gone up because of the recession, where you revenues drop and where expenditures increase because of government having to deal with more people in poverty, more people unemployed, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, explain to me how this deficit reduction in the future is going to help with what I think you agree is the number one crisis right now, and that's lack of jobs. In other words, lack of demand.
Right. The other point I raised in my reply to Dr. Krugman was that showing that you have a plan to deal with these seemingly intractable issues will boost economic confidence and certainty. You know, former Democratic Governor Ed Rendell has said a grand bargain would be the biggest sort of economic stimulus we can do in the short term, because it'll give the markets a sense that, you know, America can get its fiscal house in order. When that's unclear, not only do, you know, businesses have less certainty to hire, but it'll also could precipitate a debt crisis where, you know, holders of our bonds lose faith in our ability to pay it back and interest rates spike. And again, that's going to wreak economic catastrophe. And who knows when that tipping point is?
Well, but that isn't that the point, though? I mean, first off, isn't that the point? I mean, like I said, Japan has a much, much higher debt to GDP ratio than you're talking about. And their bonds are still at 10%. I mean, excuse me, they're 1% for a 10-year bond. I mean,
right.
So what we're talking about is all hypothetical, and with all due respect to Ed Rendell, he's a co-chair of Fix the Debt. I mean, so he's got an ideological fight in this as well, though. I mean, so I'm not, you know, Ed Rendell is not necessarily the arbiter of these things, as far as I can tell. But, I mean, aren't what you're talking about is completely hypothetical, but we know that austerity right now is going to slow economic growth, and it's economic growth that is the best way to close the deficit.
Right, and I'm not sure what I have said in our interview here that makes it seem like we're championing economic austerity right now. I think what you've heard me say is that we need to protect economic recovery in the short term and at least put a plan in place now to bring down our deficit over the long run, because we do know the path that we're on is unsustainable. You mentioned that a lot of the recent deficit is due to the economic slowdown. That's true, but we also know the true drivers of the debt are going to be in largely in these entitlement programs. You know,
well, it's not. You keep saying Social Security
last year.
You keep saying Social Security, but wait a second. But Social Security statutorily does not add a dollar to the debt.
Right, it's cash negative right now. That program. So,
well, there's a trust fund that was built specifically to deal with this demographic blip that we're going through with the baby boomers.
Right, and as you know, there is no money in that trust fund. It's a bunch of intergovernmental IOUs.
So, well, wait a second. That's like saying there's no money in my bank account either, because they've lent it out. I mean, they owe me the money in the same way that we owe anybody the money. The money, it's an obligation. It would be the first time the U.S. government would ever default on any of its debt.
Sure, but what I'm saying is that that money will eventually have to come from somewhere, and that's either going to come from, you know, fewer benefits or higher taxes. It's just the facts of the matter and the demography that we have right now. There used to be 16 people, you know, paying in for one person taking out. It's a much smaller ratio now, about 1 to 3. So that program, you know, like I said, isn't sustainable unless we make some common sense.
Well,
changes.
You know, the idea behind raising the payroll tax in 83 was essentially, it was described by a guy named Mark Toma, the economist, who said essentially what it was, the deal at that time was, we're going to increase this trust fund, we're going to raise payroll taxes, and it's going to take pressure off of income taxes for higher earners. So why not just simply call for in the future higher taxes on the wealthy when they have to pay back essentially this loan that they borrowed from payroll taxes?
Well, I don't think we're going to get to a solution by only raising taxes or only cutting spending. We're going to need to find some common ground between both parties, because that's how big sustainable change is made in our country. And that's the type of solution that we're pushing for. The Can't Kicks Back, we have 100 chapters, you know, organizing locally in college campuses and high schools across the country. You know, other people can join us at thecan'tkicksback.org, and we're going to be bringing sort of our message of political cooperation and fiscal sanity directly to our leaders this week when we're on Capitol Hill. And
I know you got just a minute here, but how many? Where do you guys get your funding? Is it from your members or?
Some of our members gladly contribute. We have funding from individuals across the political spectrum. We're a nonprofit C3 organization, and we also do appreciate the some seed money came from the Campaign to Fix the Debt to help get this effort off the ground last year.
I mean, it's mostly. I mean, a lot of it's Pete Peterson stuff, isn't it? And that's, you know, that's fine. He's certainly in a position to give it, but it's, I think it's important to know, you know, that, you know, where this money's coming from. I mean, because there's a lot of people who argue that there's a big agenda here to avoid things like taxes on the wealthy, and you have a bunch of hedge funders funding your organization. It, you know, it raises some questions as to whether or not that claim is true.
That's legitimate questions, but I encourage people who are concerned about it to read our story. You know, the young people who are involved in launching this effort, we've been involved since 2009 with the same message, because we care about the future of our country, and we don't want to be the first generation inheriting a country worse off than our parents had, and that's why we're doing this, and we think it's going to take some shared sacrifice to get there, and people need to move off their ideologies and talking points in order to do so.
Who, when you say shared sacrifice, who's going to be, I mean, aside from obviously – you know, folks who are getting cut on Social Security or Medicare, what are the other calls for sacrifice that you're talking about?
Well, we're talking about how to get back to, you know, fiscal sanity, that it can't just be cuts coming out of the discretionary budget, largely jeopardizing crucial investments in the future. We need sacrifice between all generations, which is why we need to look at both, you know, pro-growth progressive tax reform with fundamental entitlement reform.
No, but I'm saying if the sacrifice on one end is cuts to Social Security, cuts to Medicare, meaning that individuals will have to pay more for their health insurance outside of that system, where's the other sacrifice coming from?
Well, I can tell you, like, for example, the young generation now, we've already sacrificed a lot through these cuts in discretionary spending with largely benefits investments in the future. The wealthy have given some through the deal that was struck in the fiscal cliff. There's probably still a bit more to be done.
Well, that just simply raised rates back to where they were in 1990. I mean, you don't really think that for someone making over 450 grand a year that a couple of thousand more is equivalent to losing, you know, I mean, if Social Security provides 60% of your income when you're for 50% of the country, you're not saying that's the equivalent sacrifice. I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, we're talking about, when we talk about benefit cuts, we're talking about someone actually in their retirement who doesn't have a 401k, which, you know, recent studies show about 50% of the people don't have nearly enough for retirement in this country. Those are real sacrifices felt on a daily basis. I'm just curious what, when you say shared sacrifice, that term is always sort of sticks in my craw, because I'm always wondering what the sacrifice is going to be if you're, let's say, a millionaire or a billionaire.
Right, and we're talking about that when we talk about the ways that we can reform the tax code and closing a lot of the loopholes that primarily benefit upper-income individuals. But there's a lot more to be done in every way that we can reduce a deficit. We still have about $2.5 trillion more to go in order to bring our debt down to a sustainable level and put it on a downward path. And that's the conversation we think we ought to be having in the weeks ahead. And yeah. I appreciate the opportunity to come on your show and speak to you about that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your time today. But we can both agree right now, everything we should be doing should be to promote more jobs, right?
I do think it's important that we grow the economy, and the best way to do that is also ensuring that we have a plan to tackle our unsustainable fiscal course.
What if it's an either-or situation?
It's not an either-or situation. I know that, like, when you're, you know, wearing your ideological glasses, the world is black and white. But I think if we have some sensible leadership in Washington,
Wait a second. Let me take my glasses off for a second. Let me take my glasses off. All right. I'm going by what the IMF says. I'm going by what's happened in Great Britain, what's happened all through Europe. When you cut government spending at a time of anemic economic private sector growth, you grow the deficit, you grow the debt, and you cut jobs. And so for right now, we shouldn't be, I mean, like, for instance, on the sequester, you see that this is going to be problematic for economic growth, yes?
I think a lot of the cuts that need to happen ought to be phased in gradually, and they ought to be made in ways that we prioritize what spending we cut when.
Give me a timeline when you say phased in. Should we benchmark it to?
We can get going on now, but I think a lot we can save for later. But having a plan is probably the most important thing.
Well, I got no problem with the plan. We have plans out there, but I guess what I'm saying is that when you say phase in, should we benchmark this to an employment number? In other words, if we get to 5% unemployment, then we can start worrying about these things?
I think the most important thing is that we have a plan to get our, you know, debt down below 70% of GDP in the next 10 years and put it on a downward path.
But how do we do that without doing government cutting now? That's austerity, isn't it?
Right. I think I shared many of those ideas with you today, and unfortunately I have to run now, Sam.
Okay, I understand. All right, well, I appreciate your time today, Nick.
All right,
thanks
thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, folks, there you have it.
Your ideological blinders are right back on.
I put my ideological glasses back on. I mean, you know, there's a lot of hedging here. There's a lot of, play the dance again. That's why I think there's a lot of dancing involved in this.
I just think from the actually going to play that again?
Yeah, a little bit of background. Let's have this conversation with a little bit of background.
All right. This is ridiculous. I can't focus.
You can't see this on the YouTube right now, but Michael is literally shaking his entire body doing the Harlem Shake.
He can't help himself.
I can't. I'm laughing like George Bush.
No, the kid is very well-spoken, but he's not. I didn't hear anything that was really addressing a lot of my questions.
He didn't address it, but I would just say, like, if I'm going to adapt, you know, speaking from that generational perspective or whatever, there's two things, right? In the short terms, it's jobs. And what's the real long-term problem that we actually face? That's climate change, global warming.
Well, yes.
So you're talking about we're in this huge crisis. Sure. There's a massive employment crisis for young people, especially in Europe and even here. And then in the long term, when we actually come of age, if half of the science about global warming is legitimate,
right.
Are you kidding
but
me?
Let's stay on topic in terms of this narrow thing. I agree with you.
I enjoyed that whenever you brought up a point, he said, I agree, Social Security and Medicare.
But the problem with what he is offering is that there is no line that he can draw between the plan that we need to act on now and jobs and growth, other than this notion of confidence. And this is exactly what was prescribed for Europe. We're going to cut and give confidence to people and to the business sector. And what we've seen is the economies go in the tank. Double dip recessions, maybe triple dip recessions as a function of this. And the idea that we're talking about closing loopholes will be some sort of shared sacrifice is a joke as well. Look, the bottom line is the agenda of these people is to use this crisis as some type of smokescreen to cut benefits from retirement programs. That's basically it. We can see, look, right now, the Congress could say, we're going to cancel the sequester. All the plans in the world that they had to make all these cuts can be cut right now by Congress. Any plans that we make now about cutting things in the future can be cut, can be reversed by Congress then. But you know, if these hedge funder guys, these Wall Street guys get their hands on that Social Security money, they're not going to give it back. That is the plan. If you're really concerned about the deficit, there are things like financial transaction taxes that these guys won't bring up. It's just closed loopholes, but of course they won't bring it up.
That's right. You could have progressive austerity, which wouldn't be the right strategy.
Ed
now
Randall,
either.
Senior advisor at Greenhill Company, a multinational investment bank. I mean, we know why Ed Randall is pushing this. It's the same reason why Pete Peterson's pushing it. I don't care what party he's from. That doesn't make a difference. He's from the money party. He just puts on his Democratic bona fides coat as a way to agitate for that stuff. So, but he was well-spoken, that kid. I mean, for such a young guy.
I'll hand it to him for coming on the show.
And got to give him credit for coming on the show.
I give him minimal credit.
I appreciate the awareness of the Harlem Shuffle that is going forward.
Shake.
And again, shake. And the bottom line is there is one primary long-term driver of our long-term debt, and that is not Medicare. Medicare is simply the means in which people pay for what is the long-term driver, and that is healthcare. And healthcare expenses are out of control. And there is one reason why that is the case relative to every other industrialized nation in the world. And that is because without the capacity of having a single payer or a primary payer for these services, there's no way to control costs.
At the end of the day, there is only one way to get those healthcare costs under control, and that is to have a single payer system which will negotiate with pharmaceutical companies to get discounts, volume discounts on drugs, to have a single payer provider of health insurance who will negotiate with hospitals and medical care providers. You go in now, it depends. If you're getting a hip replacement surgery or whatever it is, how much that costs is a function of the deal that different insurance companies have made. And they all have different rates. And maybe it's because the guy at the hospital goes on golf junkets with the guy from one insurance company and not another. But you need the way you control those costs are to have one buyer who is providing the insurance payments to those providers. And that's why Medicare, the rate of growth of the cost of healthcare under Medicare is substantially slower than it is in the private insurance industry. And it could be that much slower if we were all under one program. So this talk of supposed shared sacrifice, where loopholes will be supposedly closed for the very wealthy in this country, is just—it's just a lie.
And also, and loopholes will always be reopened. Social Security will very unlikely be recreated.
Indeed, indeed. We saw this in '86. Fred Grandy, of all people, Gopher, who was a congressman at that time, sitting on the set of the Larry Kudlow show, said this to both Larry and I. Well, you know, we closed the loopholes in '86 when we brought down the rates. The rates stayed down, and the loopholes got reopened. Loopholes is exactly what you close when you don't want the rich to pay more taxes in the long term. Cuts on Social Security, raises in the Social Security wage tax. That's like herpes. That's forever.
And can I just say one other thing, too? I think it's so important to emphasize what they did in the UK, because they actually did. Like, they cut defense spending. They tried to broaden tax rates. I mean, they did, from this austerity perspective, they did have shared sacrifice. And not only have they continued being in a recession, they're not even going to meet their deficit cuts.
What happens is you quash demand, then you quash revenue, and then your deficits grow. You cannot cut quick enough to get ahead of the destruction of the economy that is destroying your revenue base. You can't get ahead of it. It's just a spiral downward. And when we talk about phasing in, we talk about gradual cuts and some now, but we won't say what they should be and how they won't impact the economy. Those are the answers we can't get. We get more of the Harlem Shake.
I closed the video.
You did?
Oh,
God.
Thought we were done with it.
Well, I'm never done with it. I want to keep playing that forever.
I thought the Gangnam Style one was better.
The Gangnam Style one was probably better. All right, folks. We're going to take a break. Number 646-257-3920. There you go. There you go. You can become a member of this program and support it. Let's see some shared sacrifice, people. In all honesty, if you can afford to pay for a Majority Report membership, please do. We endeavor every day to bring you the finest of audio product, unheard anywhere. If there's anyone else who is going to have someone from The Can Kicks Back for 25 minutes, 30 minutes, do an in-depth interview with them, fully researched, then by all means support that program. If you cannot find that program, please support this one. It is 30 cents a day, virtually nothing. Does not contribute to the long-term deficit or the short-term
phased
deficit.
In.
Phased in over a certain period of time. You can become a member at majority.fm. Of course, you can support the show in other ways. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. You can give us a good review on iTunes. You can subscribe to our YouTube account. Spread our YouTubes around. We will have a clip of this up, probably in two parts. Spread this around. And if you want to be a part of the program, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number to call in. We'll be right back after this.